The Handmaid's Tale, Cassette 6.
The night before we left the house that last time, I was walking through the rooms. Nothing was packed up because we weren't taking much with us, and we couldn't afford even then to give the least appearance of leaving. So I was just walking through, here and there, looking at things, at the arrangement we had made together for our life. I had some idea that I would be able to remember afterwards what it had looked like. Luke was in the living room. He put his arms around me. We were both feeling miserable. How were we to know we were happy even then? Because we at least had that, arms around. "The cat," is what he said. "Cat," I said against the wool of his sweater. "We can't just leave her here." I hadn't thought about the cat. Neither of us had. Our decision had been sudden. And then there had been the planning to do. I must have thought she was coming with us. But she couldn't. You don't take a cat on a day trip across the border. "Why not outside?" I said. "We could just leave her. She'd hang around and mew at the door. Someone would notice we were gone." "We could give her away," I said. "One of the neighbors." Even as I said this, I saw how foolish that would be. "I'll take care of it," Luke said. And because he said it instead of her, I knew he meant kill. "That is what you have to do before you kill," I thought. "You have to create an it where none was before. You do that first in your head, and then you make it real." "So that's how they do it," I thought. I seemed never to have known that before. Luke found the cat, who was hiding under our bed. They always know. He went into the garage with her. I don't know what he did, and I never asked him. I sat in the living room, hands folded in my lap. I should have gone out with him, taken that small responsibility. I should at least have asked him about it afterwards, so he didn't have to carry it alone, because that little sacrifice, that snuffing out of love, was done for my sake as well. That's one of the things they do. They force you to kill within yourself. Useless, as it turned out. I wonder who told them. It could have been a neighbor watching our car pull away from the driveway in the morning, acting on a hunch, tipping them off for a gold star on someone's list. It could even have been the man who got us the passports. Why not get paid twice? Like them, even, to plant the passport forgers themselves, a net for the unwary. The eyes of God run over all the earth. Because they were ready for us and waiting. The moment of betrayal is the worst, the moment when you know beyond any doubt that you've been betrayed, that some other human being has wished you that much evil. It was like being in an elevator cut loose at the top, falling, and not knowing when you will hit. I try to conjure, to raise my own spirits from wherever they are. I need to remember what they look like. I try to hold them still behind my eyes, their faces like pictures in an album, but they won't stay still for me. They move. There's a smile and it's gone. Their features curl and bend as if the paper's burning. Blackness eats them. A glimpse. A pale shimmer on the air, a glow, aurora, dance of electrons, then a face again. Faces. But they fade, though I stretch out my arms toward them. They slip away from me, ghosts at daybreak, back to wherever they are. "Stay with me," I want to say, but they won't. It's my fault. I am forgetting too much. Tonight I will say my prayers, no longer kneeling at the foot of the bed, knees on the hard wood of the gym floor, Aunt Elizabeth standing by the double doors, arms folded, cattle prod hung on her belt, while Aunt Lydia strides along the rows of kneeling nightgowned women, hitting our backs or feet or bums or arms lightly, just a flick, a tap, with her wooden pointer if we slouch or slacken. She wanted our heads bowed just right, our toes together and pointed, our elbows at a proper angle. Part of her interest in this was aesthetic. She liked the look of the thing. She wanted us to look like something Anglo-Saxon, carved on a tomb, or Christmas card angels regimented in our robes of purity. But she knew, too, the spiritual value of bodily rigidity, of muscle strain. A little pain cleans out the mind, she'd say. What we prayed for was emptiness, so we would be worthy to be filled with grace, with love, with self-denial, semen, and babies. Oh, God, King of the universe, thank you for not creating me a man. Oh, God, obliterate me, make me fruitful, mortify my flesh that I may be multiplied. Let me be fulfilled. Some of them would get carried away with this, the ecstasy of abasement. Some of them would moan and cry. There is no point in making a spectacle of yourself, Janine, said Aunt Lydia. I pray where I am, sitting by the window, looking out through the curtain at the empty garden. I don't even close my eyes. Out there, or inside my head, it's an equal darkness or light. My God, who art in the kingdom of heaven, which is within, I wish you would tell me your name, the real one, I mean. But you will do as well as anything. I wish I knew what you were up to. But whatever it is, help me to get through it, please. Though maybe it's not your doing, I don't believe for an instant that what's going on out there is what you meant. I have enough daily bread, so I won't waste time on that. It isn't the main problem. The problem is getting it down without choking on it. Now we come to forgiveness. Don't worry about forgiving me right now. There are more important things. For instance, keep the others safe, if they are safe. Don't let them suffer too much. If they have to die, let it be fast. You might even provide a heaven for them. We need you for that. Hell we can make for ourselves. I suppose I should say, I forgive whoever did this and whatever they're doing now. I'll try, but it isn't easy. Temptation comes next. At the center, temptation was anything much more than eating and sleeping. Knowing was a temptation. What you don't know won't tempt you, Aunt Lydia used to say. Maybe I don't really want to know what's going on. Maybe I'd rather not know. Maybe I couldn't bear to know. The fall was a fall from innocence to knowledge. I think about the chandelier too much, though it's gone now. But you could use a hook in the closet. I've considered the possibilities. All you'd have to do after attaching yourself would be to lean your weight forward and not fight. Deliver us from evil. Then there's kingdom, power, and glory. It takes a lot to believe in those right now, but I'll try it anyway. In hope, as they say on the gravestones. You must feel pretty ripped off. I guess it's not the first time. If I were you, I'd be fed up. I'd really be sick of it. I guess that's the difference between us. I feel very unreal talking to you like this. I feel as if I'm talking to a wall. I wish you'd answer. I feel so alone. All alone by the telephone. Except I can't use the telephone. And if I could, who would I call? Oh, God. It's no joke. Oh, God. Oh, God. How can I keep on living? Jezebel's, 31. Every night when I go to bed, I think, in the morning, I will wake up in my own house and things will be back the way they were. It hasn't happened this morning, either. I put on my clothes, summer clothes. It's still summer. It seems to have stopped at summer. July, its breathless days and sauna nights, hard to sleep. I make a point of keeping track. I should scratch marks on the wall, one for each day of the week, and run a line through them when I have 7. But what would be the use? This isn't a jail sentence. There's no time here that can be done and finished with. Anyway, all I have to do is ask to find out what day it is. Yesterday was July the 4th, which used to be Independence Day before they abolished it. September 1st will be Labor Day. They still have that, though it didn't used to have anything to do with mothers. But I tell time by the moon, lunar, not solar. I bend over to do up my red shoes, lighter weight these days with discreet slits cut in them, though nothing so daring as sandals. It's an effort to stoop. Despite the exercises, I can feel my body gradually seizing up, refusing. Being a woman this way is how I used to imagine it would be to be very old. I feel I even walk like that, crouched over, my spine constricting to a question mark, my bones leached of calcium and porous as limestone. When I was younger, imagining age, I would think, maybe you appreciate things more when you don't have much time left. I forgot to include the loss of energy. Some days I do appreciate things more, eggs, flowers, but then I decide I'm only having an attack of sentimentality, my brain going pastel technicolor, like the beautiful sunset greeting cards they used to make so many of in California, high gloss hearts. The danger is gray out. I'd like to have Luke here in this bedroom while I'm getting dressed so I could have a fight with him. Absurd, but that's what I want. An argument about who should put the dishes in the dishwasher, whose turn it is to sort the laundry, clean the toilet, something daily and unimportant in the big scheme of things. We could even have a fight about that, about unimportant, important. What a luxury it would be. Not that we did it much. These days I script whole fights in my head, and the reconciliations afterwards, too. I sit in my chair, the wreath on the ceiling floating above my head like a frozen halo, a zero. A hole in space where a star exploded. A ring on water where a stone's been thrown. All things white and circular. I wait for the day to unroll, for the earth to turn, according to the round face of the implacable clock. The geometrical days which go around and around, smoothly and oiled. Sweat already on my upper lip, I wait for the arrival of the inevitable egg, which will be lukewarm like the room and will have a green film on the yolk and will taste faintly of sulfur. Today, later, with Ob Glenn on our shopping walk. We go to the church as usual and look at the graves, then to the wall. Only 2 hanging on it today, one Catholic, not a priest though, placarded with an upside-down cross, and some other sect I don't recognize. The body is marked only with a J in red. It doesn't mean Jewish. Those would be yellow stars. Anyway, there haven't been many of them. Because they were declared sons of Jacob, and therefore special, they were given a choice. They could convert or emigrate to Israel. A lot of them emigrated, if you can believe the news. I saw a boatload of them on the TV, leaning over the railings in their black coats and hats and their long beards, trying to look as Jewish as possible, in costumes fished up from the past, the women with shawls over their heads, smiling and waving, a little stiffly, it's true, as if they were posing, and another shot of the richer ones lining up for the planes. Ob Glenn says some other people got out that way by pretending to be Jewish, but it wasn't easy because of the tests they gave you, and they've tightened up on that now. You don't get hanged only for being a Jew, though. You get hanged for being a noisy Jew who won't make the choice, or for pretending to convert, That's been on the TV, too. Raids at night, secret hordes of Jewish things dragged from under beds, Torahs, Talits, Mogen Davids, and the owners of them, sullen-faced, unrepentant, pushed by the eyes against the walls of their bedrooms, while the sorrowful voice of the announcer tells us, voice over, about their perfidy and ungratefulness. So the J isn't for Jew. What could it be? Jehovah's Witness? Jesuit? Whatever it meant, he's just as dead. After this ritual viewing, we continue on our way, heading, as usual, for some open space we can cross so we can talk. If you can call it talking, these clipped whispers projected through the funnels of our white wings, it's more like a telegram, a verbal semaphore, amputated speech. We can never stand long in any one place. We don't want to be picked up for loitering. Today we turn in the opposite direction from Soul Scrolls to where there's an open park of sorts with a large old building on it, ornate late Victorian with stained glass. It used to be called Memorial Hall, though I never knew what it was a memorial for, dead people of some kind. Mara told me once that it used to be where the undergraduates ate in the earlier days of the university. If a woman went in there, they'd throw buns at her, she said. Why? I said. Mara became, over the years, increasingly versed in such anecdotes. I didn't much like it, this grudge-holding against the past. To make her go out, said Mara. Maybe it was more like throwing peanuts at elephants, I said. Mara laughed. She could always do that. Exotic monsters, she said. We stand looking at this building, which is in shape more or less like a church, a cathedral. Avglen says, I hear that's where the eyes hold their banquets. Who told you? I said. There's no one near. We can speak more freely, but out of habit we keep our voices low. The grapevine, she says. She pauses, looks sideways at me. I can sense the blur of white as her wings move. There's a password, she says. A password, I ask. What for? So you can tell, she says, who is and who isn't. Although I can't see what use it is for me to know, I ask, what is it then? Mayday, she says. I tried it on you once. Mayday, I repeat. I remember that day. Mayday. Don't use it unless you have to, says Avglen. It isn't good for us to know about too many of the others in the network. In case you get caught. I find it hard to believe in these whisperings, these revelations, although I do at the time. Afterwards, though, they seem improbable, childish even, like something you do for fun, like a girls' club, like secrets at school, or like the spy novels I used to read on weekends when I should have been finishing my homework, or like late-night television. Passwords. Things that cannot be told, people with secret identities, dark linkages. This does not seem as if it ought to be the true shape of the world. But that is my own illusion, a hangover from a version of reality I learned in the former time. And networks, networking, one of my mother's old phrases, musty slang of yesteryear. Even in her 60s, she still did something she called that. Though as far as I could see, all it meant was having lunch with some other woman. I leave Avglen at the corner. I'll see you later, she says. She glides away along the sidewalk, and I go up the walk toward the house. There's Nick, hat askew. Today he doesn't even look at me. He must have been waiting around for me, though, to deliver his silent message, because as soon as he knows I've seen him, he gives the whirlwind one last swipe with the chamois, and walks briskly off toward the garage door. I walk along the gravel between the slabs of overgreen lawn. Serena Joy is sitting under the willow tree in her chair, cane propped at her elbow. Her dress is crisp, cool cotton. For her, it's blue, watercolor, not this red of mine that sucks in heat and blazes with it at the same time. Her profile's toward me. She's knitting. How can she bear to touch the wool in this heat? But possibly her skin's gone numb. Possibly she feels nothing like one formerly scalded. I lower my eyes to the path, glide by her, hoping to be invisible, knowing I'll be ignored, but not this time. Alfred, she says. I pause, uncertain. Yes, you. I turn toward her, my blinkered sight. Come over here. I want you. I walk over the grass and stand before her, looking down. You can sit, she says. Here, take the cushion. I need you to hold this wool. She's got a cigarette, the ashtray's on the lawn beside her, and a cup of something, tea or coffee. It's too damn close in there. You need a little air, she says. I sit, putting down my basket, strawberries again, chicken again, and I note the swear word, something new. She fits the skein of wool over my two outstretched hands, starts winding. I am leashed, it looks like, manacled, cobwebbed, that's closer. The wool is gray and has absorbed moisture from the air. It's like a wetted baby blanket and smells faintly of damp sheep. At least my hands will get lanolined. Serena whines, the cigarette held in the corner of her mouth smoldering, sending out tempting smoke. She whines slowly and with difficulty because of her gradually crippling hands, but with determination. Perhaps the knitting, for her, involves a kind of willpower. Maybe it even hurts. Maybe it's been medically prescribed 10 rows a day of plain, 10 of pearl. Though she must do more than that. I see those evergreen trees and geometric boys and girls in a different light, evidence of her stubbornness and not altogether despicable. My mother did not knit or anything like that. But whenever she would bring things back from the cleaners, her good blouses, winter coats, she'd save up the safety pins and make them into a chain. Then she'd pin the chain somewhere, her bed, the pillow, a chair back, the oven mitt in the kitchen, so she wouldn't lose them. Then she'd forget about them. I would come upon them here and there in the house, the houses, tracks of her presence, remnants of some lost intention, like signs on a road that turns out to lead nowhere. Throwbacks to domesticity. Well then, Serena says. She stops winding, leaving me with my hands still garlanded with animal hair, and takes the cigarette end from her mouth to butt it out. Nothing yet? I know what she's talking about. There are not that many subjects that could be spoken about between us. There's not much common ground except this one mysterious and chancy thing. No, I say, nothing. Too bad, she says. It's hard to imagine her with a baby, but the Marthas would take care of it mostly. She'd like me pregnant, though, over and done with and out of the way. No more humiliating sweaty tangles, no more flesh triangles under her starry canopy of silver flowers. Peace and quiet. I can't imagine she'd want such good luck for me, for any other reason. Your time's running out, she says. Not a question, a matter of fact. Yes, I say neutrally. She's lighting another cigarette, fumbling with the lighter. Definitely her hands are getting worse. But it would be a mistake to offer to do it for her. She'd be offended. A mistake to notice weakness in her. Maybe he can't, she says. I don't know who she means. Does she mean the commander or God? If it's God, she should say won't. Either way, it's heresy. It's only women who can't, who remain stubbornly closed, damaged, defective. No, I say, maybe he can't. I look up at her. She looks down. It's the first time we've looked into each other's eyes in a long time, since we met. The moment stretches out between us, bleak and level. She's trying to see whether or not I'm up to reality. Maybe, she says, holding the cigarette, which she has failed to light, maybe you should try it another way. Does she mean on all fours? What other way, I say. I must keep serious. Another man, she says. You know I can't, I say, careful not to let my irritation show. It's against the law. You know the penalty.
Yes,
she says. She's ready for this. She's thought it through. I know you can't officially, but it's done. Women do it frequently, all the time. With doctors, you mean? I say, remembering the sympathetic brown eyes, the gloveless hand. The last time I went, it was a different doctor. Maybe someone caught him out, or a woman reported him. Not that they'd take her word, without evidence. Some do that, she says, her tone almost affable now, though distanced. It's as if we're considering a choice of nail polish. That's how Av Warren did it. The wife knew, of course. She pauses to let this sink in. I would help you. I would make sure nothing went wrong. I think about this. Not with a doctor, I say. No, she agrees, and for this moment, at least, we are cronies. This could be a kitchen table. It could be a date we're discussing, some girlish stratagem of ploys and flirtation. Sometimes they blackmail. But it doesn't have to be a doctor. It could be someone we trust. Who? I say. I was thinking of Nick, she says, and her voice is almost soft. He's been with us a long time. He's loyal. I could fix it with him. So that's who does her little black market errands for her. Is this what he always gets, in return? What about the commander, I say. Well, she says with firmness, no more than that, a clenched look like a purse snapping shut. We just won't tell him, will we? This idea hangs between us, almost visible, almost palpable, heavy, formless, dark, collusion of a sort, betrayal of a sort. She does want that baby. It's a risk, I say. More than that. It's my life on the line. But that's where it will be sooner or later, one way or another, whatever I do or don't. We both know this. You might as well, she says, which is what I think, too. All right, I say. Yes. She leans forward. Maybe I could get something for you, she says, because I have been good. Something you want, she adds, wheedling almost. What's that, I say. I can't think of anything I truly want that she'd be likely to, or able to give me. A picture, she says, as if offering me some juvenile treat, an ice cream, a trip to the zoo. I look up at her again, puzzled. Of her, she says, your little girl, but only maybe. She knows where they've put her then, where they're keeping her. She's known all along. Something chokes in my throat. The bitch, not to tell me, bring me news, any news at all, not even to let on. She's made of wood or iron. She can't imagine. But I can't say this. I can't lose sight, even of so small a thing. I can't let go of this hope. I can't speak. She's actually smiling, coquettishly even. There's a hint of her former small screen mannequin's allure flickering over her face like momentary static. It's too damn hot for this, don't you think? She says. She lifts the wool from my two hands, where I've been holding it all this time. Then she takes the cigarette she's been fiddling with and a little awkwardly presses it into my hand, closing my fingers around it. Find yourself a match, she says. They're in the kitchen. You can ask Rita for one. You can tell her I said so. Only the one, though, she adds roguishly. We don't want to ruin your health. 32. Rita's sitting at the kitchen table. There's a glass bowl with ice cubes floating in it on the table in front of her. Radishes made into flowers, roses or tulips bob in it. On the chopping board in front of her, she's cutting more with a paring knife, her large hands deft, indifferent. The rest of her body does not move, nor does her face. It's as if she's doing it in her sleep, this knife trick. On the white enamel surface is a pile of radishes, washed but uncut. Little Aztec hearts. She hardly bothers to look up as I enter. You got it all, huh? Is what she says as I take the parcels out for her inspection. Could I have a match? I ask her. Surprising how much like a small, begging child she makes me feel, simply by her scowl, her stolidity. How importunate and whiny. Matches, she says. What do you want matches for? She said I could have one, I say, not wanting to admit to the cigarette. Who said, she continues with the radishes, her rhythm unbroken,
No call for you to have matches. Burn the house down. You can go and ask her if you like, I say. She's out on the lawn. Rita rolls her eyes to the ceiling as if consulting silently some deity there. Then she sighs, rises heavily, and wipes her hands with ostentation on her apron to show me how much trouble I am. She goes to the cupboard over the sink, taking her time, locates her key bunch in her pocket, unlocks the cupboard door. "Keep 'em in here, Summer," she says, as if to herself. "No call for a fire in this weather." I remember from April that it's Cora who lights the fires in the sitting room and the dining room in cooler weather. The matches are wooden ones in a cardboard sliding top box, the kind I used to covet in order to make doll's drawers out of them. She opens the box, peers into it, as if deciding which one she'll let me have. "Her own business," she mutters. "No way you can tell her a thing." She punches her big hand down, selects a match, hands it over to me. "Now don't you go setting fire to nothing," she says. "Not them curtains in your room, too hot the way it is." "I won't," I say. "That's not what it's for." She does not deign to ask me what it is for. "Don't care if you eat it or what," she says. "She said you could have one, so I give you one, is all." She turns away from me and sits again at the table. Then she picks an ice cube out of the bowl and pops it into her mouth. This is an unusual thing for her to do. I've never seen her nibble while working. "You can have one of 'em, too," she says. "A shame, making you wear all them pillowcases on your head in this weather." I am surprised. She doesn't usually offer me anything. Maybe she feels that if I've risen in status enough to be given a match, she can afford her own small gesture. Have I become, suddenly, one of those who must be appeased? "Thank you," I say. I transfer the match carefully to my zippered sleeve where the cigarette is, so that it won't get wet, and take an ice cube. "Those radishes are pretty," I say, in return for the gift she's made me of her own free will. "I like to do things right, is all," she says, grumpy again. "No sense otherwise." I go along the passage, up the stairs, hurrying. In the curved hallway mirror, I flip past a red shape at the edge of my own field of vision, a wraith of red smoke. I have smoke on my mind, all right. Already I can feel it in my mouth, drawn down into the lungs, filling me in a long, rich, dirty cinnamon sigh. And then the rush as the nicotine hits the bloodstream. After all this time, it could make me sick. I wouldn't be surprised. But even that thought is welcome. Along the corridor I go. Where should I do it? In the bathroom, running the water to clear the air? In the bedroom, wheezy puffs out of the open window? Who's to catch me at it? Who knows? Even as I luxuriate in the future this way, rolling anticipation around in my mouth, I think of something else. I don't need to smoke this cigarette. I could shred it up and flush it down the toilet, or I could eat it and get the high that way. That can work, too, a little at a time, save up the rest. That way I could keep the match. I could make a small hole in the mattress, slide it carefully in. Such a thin thing would never be noticed. There it would be at night under me while I'm in bed, sleeping on it. I could burn the house down. Such a fine thought. It makes me shiver. An escape, quick and narrow. I lie on my bed, pretending to nap. The commander last night, fingers together, looking at me as I sat rubbing oily lotion into my hands. Odd. I thought about asking him for a cigarette, but decided against it. I know enough not to ask for too much at once. I don't want him to think I'm using him. Also, I don't want to interrupt him. Last night he had a drink, scotch and water. He's taken to drinking in my presence to unwind after the day, he says. I'm to gather he is under pressure. He never offers me any, though, and I don't ask. We both know what my body is for. When I kiss him good night, as if I meant it, his breath smells of alcohol, and I breathe it in like smoke. I admit I relish it, this lick of dissipation. Sometimes after a few drinks he becomes silly and cheats at Scrabble. He encourages me to do it, too, and we take extra letters and make words with them that don't exist, words like smirt and Krupp, giggling over them. Sometimes he turns on his shortwave radio, displaying before me a minute or two of Radio Free America to show me he can. Then he turns it off again. "Damn Cubans," he says, "all that filth about universal daycare." Sometimes, after the games, he sits on the floor beside my chair holding my hand. His head is a little below mine, so that when he looks up at me, it's at a juvenile angle. It must amuse him, this fake subservience. "He's way up there," says Auckland. "He's at the top, and I mean the very top." At such times, it's hard to imagine that. Occasionally, I try to put myself in his position. I do this as a tactic, to guess in advance how he may be moved to behave toward me. It's difficult for me to believe I have power over him of any sort, but I do, although it's of an equivocal kind. Once in a while, I think I can see myself, though blurrily, as he may see me. There are things he wants to prove to me, gifts he wants to bestow, services he wants to render, tendernesses he wants to inspire. He wants, all right, especially after a few drinks. Sometimes he becomes querulous, at other times philosophical, or he wishes to explain things, justify himself, as last night. "The problem wasn't only with the women," he says. "The main problem was with the men. There was nothing for them anymore." "Nothing," I say. "But they had..." "There was nothing for them to do," he says. "They could make money," I say, a little nastily. Right now I'm not afraid of him. It's hard to be afraid of a man who's sitting watching you put on hand lotion. This lack of fear is dangerous. "It's not enough," he says. "It's too abstract. I mean, there was nothing for them to do with women." "What do you mean?" I say. "What about all the porny corners? It was all over the place. They even had it motorized." "I'm not talking about sex," he says. "That was part of it. The sex was too easy. Anyone could just buy it. There was nothing to work for, nothing to fight for. We have the stats from that time. Do you know what they were complaining about the most? Inability to feel. Men were turning off on sex, even. They were turning off on marriage." "Do they feel now?" I say. "Yes," he says, looking at me. "They do." He stands up, comes around the desk to the chair where I'm sitting. He puts his hands on my shoulders from behind. I can't see him. "I like to know what you think," his voice says from behind me. "I don't think a lot," I say lightly. What he wants is intimacy, but I can't give him that. "There's hardly any point in my thinking, is there?" I say. "What I think doesn't matter," which is the only reason he can tell me things. "Come now," he says, pressing a little with his hands. "I'm interested in your opinion. You're intelligent enough. You must have an opinion." "About what?" I say. "What we've done," he says. "How things have worked out." I hold myself very still. I try to empty my mind. I think about the sky at night when there's no moon. "I have no opinion," I say. He sighs, relaxes his hands, but leaves them on my shoulders. He knows what I think, all right. "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs," is what he says. "We thought we could do better." "Better," I say in a small voice. "How can he think this is better?" "Better never means better for everyone," he says. "It always means worse for some." I lie flat. The damp air above me is like a lid, like earth. I wish it would rain. Better still, a thunderstorm, black clouds, lightning, ear-splitting sound. The electricity might go off. I could go down to the kitchen then, Sam afraid, sit with Rita and Cora around the kitchen table. They would permit my fear because it's one they share. They'd let me in. There would be candles burning. We would watch each other's faces come and go in the flickering, in the white flashes of jagged light from outside the windows. "Oh, Lord," Cora would say. "Oh, Lord, save us." The air would be clear after that, and lighter.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side two from the same point.